Welcome to the NLP View with your host, Donna Blunston. Each week, Donna will explore how the techniques of NLP can help improve your personal and professional life. And now, here's your host, Donna Blunston.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the NLP View radio show. My name is Donna Blunston. On today's show, I am joined by Grant Fuzalu and Marvin Oker, the founders and developers of MBIT, Multiple Brain Integration, using the advances in neuroscience to identify the complex and functional neural networks in both our heart and our gut. Neuro-linguistic programming, NLP, is an applied psychology of performance excellence and is often defined as an attitude and methodology that leaves behind a trail of techniques. It encourages a wanton curiosity and an experimentation through a methodology of behavioral modeling, which provides insights and understanding into the fundamental dynamics between our mind, neuro, our language, linguistics, and how their interplay affects our body and our behavior, which is the programming. As a relatively new science, NLP is constantly being researched to validate itself within a scientific underpinning and recognition of it as an independent model of psychology. NLP is an ever-moving and developing field due to its founding wanton curiosity into the mind, the language, and our behavior. Grant Fuzalu and Marvin Oker have taken off from where NLP has really left, building upon and integrating the NLP techniques with the latest research in neurology and cognitive sciences through the conduction of active research using behavioral modeling to unpack the unconscious processes of how we use our head and heart and gut brains to create meaning, enact decisions, and construct our subjective reality. So I would love to welcome to the show Grant Fuzalu and Marvin Oker. Hello, Grant. Hello, Marvin.
Hello, Donna. Hello, thank Donna. You very, very much.
Oh, you're welcome. How are you both?
Fabulous.
We're well.
It's an honour to have you both on my show today, and the work that you're doing, the way you're moving, well, you're a moving force, really, behind the development of NLP, and, well, I want to personally thank you for that.
Well, thank you. It's great to be on the show. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Before we start, could you tell our audience a bit about yourselves?
I was going to say, Grant, why don't you start?
Yes, I have a background in science and in physics. In fact, I was trained as a physicist to begin with, and along the way, during a period when I was running a research and development department, I realized that research and development is all about making organizations more effective, and that within its purview would be human excellence and techniques and technologies for increasing human skills and human effectiveness. And so I came across neuro-linguistic programming, NLP, and started studying that. And, of course, the underlying technology of that is behavioral modeling, which I find, and as Marvin does, incredibly exciting. So for many years now, we've been working as behavioral modelers. And of course, being a lifelong learner, I've followed up my various science degrees with psychology degrees. So I have a couple of psych degrees as well. So I'm passionate about research. I'm passionate about science, but I'm also passionate about pragmatic applications, and that's where I think NLP and behavioral modeling can take us to places that science can't yet go, but that follows up and validates that. So some of the stuff that Marvin and I have been doing recently has been really exciting, because we've been using neuroscience to inform behavioral modeling, and thus embraining an MBIT has come out of it.
And yourself, Marvin, what's your background?
A bit of a contrast to Grant's. I actually started off in the entertainment and show business arena. And I was born and raised in Hawaii, but I live in Australia now. And while I was doing a lot in the entertainment field, I came across NLP, and I went back to the University of Hawaii to study things like psychology and a bit of perception theory, theater, things of that nature. And that's when I ran across NLP. Over the years, I became an NLP trainer, an NLP master trainer. I was one of the first five certified by Richard Bandler to be an NLP master trainer. And myself and some colleagues, Dr. Wyatt Woodsmall and Bert Feustel over in Germany, Wyatt in Washington, D.C., we formed in the 90s, we formed the International NLP Trainers Association, which I'm still on the board. And yeah, I've known Grant for well over 20 years now, and yeah, every so often, Grant and I would have these dinners, and Grant would always be telling me about the latest research that he'd be into, and I've always found it very fascinating. And I was doing a lot of making my living doing behavioral modeling for a lot of corporate work, working with a lot of executive teams, dealing with complex strategies, and creating various types of behavioral modeling projects that would fit some of their adaptive situations. And Grant would be always telling me about these latest neuroscience findings that he'd be coming across, and we'd have these wildly exciting dinners. And then one day it occurred to me, and I said to Grant, have you been telling me that science has been studying all this great research about a heart brain and a gut brain, and no one's really brought them together in the way that we've been having these conversations at dinner? And he said, yes, that's what I've been trying to tell you. And I said, oh, my gosh, so let's start bringing this together. So we spent the last several years pulling this together, and that's when we started to develop MBID, or multiple brain integration techniques. And it is wildly exciting. As Grant said, neuroscience now is starting to prove not only what NLP has been saying for decades, but neuroscience now is being able to prove what ancient wisdom traditions have been saying for over 2,500 to 3,500 years, that there is an intelligence in the heart and there is an intelligence in the gut, and the significance for people are profound.
That's one when reading your book, actually, looking back at that, even though I'd looked into the embraining when I've, as myself, I'm learning more and more and advancing my own skills, and as I was starting to research, preparing really for the interview, it wasn't until I started reading the book and realised of how, as you rightfully say, it does link back to all the ancient wisdom, to our wise and monks of the past, and their whole attitude about taking the deep breath in to open your mind and clear your heart, and how a pure mind needs to be pure in heart. All these things, as you say, that's been there for decades, centuries upon centuries, that we repeat and we see all the time in mantras and inspirational quotes, that and philosophy,
philosophical.
That's the one. Thank you. Views that are out there that we repeat. But it's not until you think about them that they're actually telling us, and we're repeating what you're researching.
Yes, and as Glenn's pointed out, it's a combination of what neuroscience is saying combined with behavioral modeling. So what Grant and I did is we looked at what the neuroscience was saying, and that informed our behavioral modeling. We didn't just stop with science. We took it a bit further and said, well, what science has proven so far, how should that be able to show up in human behavior? And can we find any exceptions when humans do whatever they do? Can science at least go part way in explaining a lot of that? What models can we come up with then? And as you say, ancient wisdom traditions and philosophies have been saying so many things for many years, that there's a reason why the heart is very, very important, and why the heart needs to lead. In traditional Chinese medicine, they have a phrase called the heart is the emperor. And this translates into a lot of our techniques around how the heart leads, and that the heart intelligence actually needs to fuel the head intelligence, and not the other way around, because if the head intelligence starts, well, the head can come up with all sorts of stories and sometimes freak out the heart. You know, as we know it in NLP, the head can come up with all sorts of internal representations. It can make pictures in its head. It can say things to itself. It can create all sorts of sensations by what's going on in the head. That the heart can become incredibly either disempowered or disheartened, or it can be enlivened and joyful at the same time. But to start with the heart, to start with what's important with people, to start with your values and deep-set feelings, and let that then drive your head, is a lot what NLP is saying, where things need to start with a state first. If you can access an internal state, then that changes a lot of your internal strategies and your external behaviors.
It does, and it informs and dictates our subjective experience.
Exactly. Exactly. And certain classes of heart-based intelligence or heart-based functionings have different qualities, hence why we see so many different philosophical approaches and wisdom practices all advise that we start with a sense of compassion first. And in our work, we call this one of the highest expressions of the heart, and it's naturally integrative with the head and the gut brains as well. There's something very unique about compassion, and it's related to what you said earlier around how the breathing processes that are involved. Now, there are two parts of the autonomic nervous system, and it's interestingly enough, NLP in the early days, NLP, well, it did mention the autonomic nervous system very quickly in one of its earlier books. It didn't go much farther with it. The autonomic nervous system has two arms. It has the sympathetic and the parasympathetic, which is responsible for, the sympathetic is responsible for our stress response, our fight or flight syndrome, and our parasympathetic is responsible for our relaxation and if it goes too far, some apathy and depression type states. And these two systems need to be in balance. And science has shown that one of the mechanisms that keeps the sympathetic and parasympathetic in balance is breathing. And there's a particular way of breathing that allows the sympathetic and parasympathetic systems to come into what's called coherence, where it was, as measured through heart rate variability, we start to find a beautiful sine wave start to emerge through a particular breathing pattern that we've embodied in MBIT. And this is why every spiritual practice, every wisdom practice, almost practically most health practices, they all have some kind of a breathing component into it, because it's a gateway straight in into balancing the autonomic nervous system. And when that happens, then you can access higher order functioning states such as compassion or courage or creativity.
Yes, and that's something that we see in multiple disciplines outside of psychology, per se, with regards to a lot of our Tai Chi and other, I suppose, in lots of ways, we often will go to that form of an exercise in a way to control stress or anxiety, in a way of calming and controlling ourselves, or that whole thing of a more centered sense of being.
Yes, exactly.
Which will then, it's that whole balancing yourself and aligning yourself so that your purpose, your identity, your sense of self is all integrated in one.
Yes, exactly right. And there's three aspects to the breathing, which is or the breathing processes. So one is, there are times, as you say, in certain types of activities, you might need to alter your breathing pattern to stimulate the sympathetic system, or you need to amp up a little bit. So if you're going to do some pretty extreme sports, for instance. But there's other times we've had a stressful day, and so we need to actually more emphasize the parasympathetic mode so we can start to relax. Then there's other times when we need to get into higher order states of consciousness, where we need more of a balanced state or a coherent state between the two functions of the autonomic nervous system. And again, the breathing and some physical activities make a difference. And as you say, part of it is now integrating, you know, a greater sense of both calmness as well as higher effectiveness within a sense of self, expanding one's sense of identity. And we find that that's one of the functions of the gut brain, not the head brain. Mm. The gut is going to be responsible for certain classes of things, such as core identity. And hence why when people talk about, you know, they have a gut response or feel things in their gut, the neurolinguistics of that is indicating what's actually occurring in the gut. And we find three things the gut is particularly responsible for or good at. One is maintaining your core identity. Another is safety and protection, or your boundaries, your sense of boundaries come into play. As well as, thirdly, mobilization, or going into action. We hear it in the classic neurolinguistics. If someone has guts or they don't have the guts to do something, it means they don't have the courage or the will to act. When someone often has a gut instinct in times of danger or fear, you can start to find the gut is responsible for maintaining safety and protection. Many martial arts train the gut area to work from. And again, when people can feel it in their gut, or they need time to, if you listen to the gustatory predicates from a neurolinguistic perspective, when people say things like they need to digest that, or they need to chew on that for a while, it's all referencing the gut or the digestive system into assimilating it back into self, assimilating something new to self.
I found the whole gut brain very, very interesting and intriguing from a nurse perspective, from the medical side, especially when we look to think that it's only, well, over 100 years ago now, that a doctor, Michael, is it Kirshens, who discovered that we have a complex local nervous mechanism in the gut that attributed to the ability of the gut to function autonomously, and that it wasn't dependent upon instruction, if you like, from the heart or the brain. with regards to the function of the bowels and that the whole senses of the knotting up, linking into like your irritable bowel syndrome and that side, which I guess links into what you were saying, Marvin, of how from a semantics point of view, the language that we use referring to you feel it in your gut or something doesn't feel right. People often will tell you to listen to your gut. What's your gut telling you? Gut instincts.
Yeah.
Where did you and I suppose your work, where did that take you when you started looking at the history and linking in your findings and the neuroscience? Where did that side of the previous history and research start taking you in the development of embraining?
Yeah, Grant's in a much better position to answer that. So over to you, Grant.
Thank you, Marvin. one of the things that I did was I looked back at both what we know from an embryological perspective of development in the womb, as well as what we know from an evolutionary perspective, because if we look at how the different neural networks, different brains developed, and what their functions were back in evolutionary terms, it can inform us as to the sorts of functions and competencies we might be looking at and then doing behavioral modeling on. And equally, I look to see what's been known, you know, from a historical perspective about this. And as you were saying, it's really fascinating because the knowledge of the enteric brain or gut brain has only been known about for the last 15 odd years, 20 years, by Dr. Michael Gershon, or Professor Gershon, and in his work and his great book, which he wrote called The Second Brain. So he was the one who started calling it a brain and saying this complex autonomous nervous system that can operate completely independently of the head brain has all of the hallmarks, all of the components, the same neurotransmitters, the same functional pieces as the head brain. So it deserves to be called a brain in its own right. But interestingly, I've got a book that harkens back to 1895, and I think that's what you're talking about, which is Byron Robinson, MD, so a Western medical doctor, had actually found evidence for a gut brain, a complex nervous system in the gut, and he wrote an anatomy textbook. But interestingly in it, he also said that there's evidence for a reproductive brain. So he believed there was a sex brain and a gut brain. That then got lost in the annals of medical science. His anatomy books didn't win the day and didn't become the main anatomy books that were taught in medical school. And we lost the knowledge of the enteric brain, and it's only been in the last 15 odd years that that's been rediscovered. But so far, neuroscience hasn't rediscovered the reproductive brain. That has not been given focus yet. And that's one of the reasons why we called M-bit rather than 3-bit, which wouldn't sound as good anyway, but rather than 3-brain technology, but multiple brain, because we recognize that currently science is saying there's a head, heart, and gut brain. But we expect over the next decade or so that neuroscience will start to validate that there are other complex neural networks that have sufficient complexity to be called a brain. In fact, I've come across a couple of scientific papers that say that the vagus plexus, that the vagus nerve, that vagus means wandering, so the wandering nerve that connects the heart and gut to the head has sufficient complexity and sufficient components to be called a brain in its own right. So in some ways it's a misnomer to even say that we have separate brains. We really are a mind-body, where it's complex.
Yeah.
Nervous system, that neural network, but it has nodes of complexity. That there's more complexity than others, and each of these nodes of complexity, like in the heart and the gut and the head, potentially down the reproductive system, have their own competencies and functions that they do for us. So in MBIT, we talked about the prime functions and then the core competencies that we modelled from using the neuroscience findings and the medical findings to directionalize the sorts of things we were looking for. And then we'd go out and find exemplars, people who were incredibly good. For example, we found that courage and fear, two sides of the same coin in terms of two sides of the autonomic nervous system response. And we went and found exemplars of courage and people who also were very responsive to fear. And we behavioral modeled how they did themselves subjectively in doing courage and fear, and some really fascinating work came out of that. And I might toss it over to Marvin to talk about some of the interesting neurolinguistics of courage, of encore.
Yeah, we wrestled with this for a while because we saw in our behavioral modeling that when people demonstrated courage, it was clearly from the gut brain, and people have, you know, they have this courage, they have the guts to actually do something in a scary situation, and we start to notice, well, hang on, wait a minute. So one of the characteristics that makes courage is that it occurs when fear is occurring. Without fear, then it's not courage; it's simply confidence. So, you know, how is that occurring? Because we also know fear is also occurring in the gut, because people fear, they have, you know, anywhere from the mild anxiety or butterflies in the stomach, all the way to when people are really afraid, their gut starts to tremble. They might even throw up, or they might even, you know, have loose bowels, whatever it might be. But there's something, clearly the gut is processing this protection and risk issue. So first, two things start to arise for us. One is, how is it possible that both of those things are occurring in the gut? And we start to find, well, this is very interesting. Most people, again, through behavioral modeling, we find when people experience fear, they experience it in the front of the gut. So it becomes, you know, that the butterflies in the stomach occur in the front part. But when people have courage, it comes from the back of the gut. And again, you hear it in neurolinguistics when people say people need backbone to do something. Or people who have been in courageous situations always describe it as feeling pushed into the situation. Nobody who is courageous says, I got pulled into the situation. but we also then said, well, hang on, we've got a second anomaly going on, because the etymology of the word courage is French. It is encore. It means from the heart. So how can courage come from the heart? What's going on here? And we start to explore it more again, informed by neuroscience. Again, but however, not limited to it, we looked at the behavioral modeling aspects and started to find people who went through courage, and not just went from everyday courage, but also Grant found a fantastic role model of someone who was under gunfire and actually was being had to protect about 100 people within a war-torn country. And what he had to do, a gentleman named Will Scully, and what he had to do to actually muster up the courage of things. And we find a very obvious pattern starting to emerge, which is, why would someone have courage to push through fear? They literally use those words, I pushed through fear. So something from the back pushes through to the front of their gut. Why would someone bother doing this? Well, we find through our behavioral modeling, it's because there is a core value from the heart that is more important than the fear. Whether it's protecting loved ones, or it's protecting a core sense of values, where it's fighting for freedom for your country, whatever it might be. But there's a core value from the heart that then sends a directive down to the gut that says the value is more important than the sensations of fear. So the person then pushes through that fear and uses a different part of their gut brain to do that. So here we find this fantastic set of ways of unpacking what we're seeing in real life regarding fear and courage, but also the relationship between the heart brain and the gut brain in this particular case.
Wow, it's so fascinating. It's so fascinating. I mean, that links into all of our your motivation, which one of the prime primes of the gut brain is mobilization.
Yes,
so I guess that links into the motivation from the heart that's then in effect mobilizing the will of the gut.
Exactly. And we've got different types of motivation that are in play as well. We've got the ones that are, as you're just pointing out, driven by values from the heart. And so the communications from the signals from the heart go down to the gut, and therefore the gut acts upon these values. That's why it's important to start with the heart. At the same time, we've also found people, particularly athletes or people that are very big on a consistent exercise regime, for instance, sometimes they can go just straight to the gut, and they just simply have, it's the classic Nike phrase, just do it. And it's one of those where the gut just goes into action. They've trained their gut to just act, despite how they're feeling otherwise. And so they might have certain kinds of emotional feelings in the morning where, oh, they don't feel like exercising and it's cold and they'd rather stay in bed, but the gut takes over and the gut says, we're just doing it. Right? They just go into action. Then they bypass any rationalization of the head or any limiting feelings from the heart, and they just go forth and just act. And in some ways, it's fantastic and it's very empowering, but it does need some ecology around it. Otherwise, it could get you into all sorts of trouble as well.
Yes, very true. Very true.
It's also the structure of impulsiveness. That's right.
I guess then would link into us and our meta programs and our personality traits.
Yeah, well, certainly.
I'm conscious of our time, which is going past so quickly. How can we use this as coaches and as individuals to inform ourselves for more self-awareness as the coach, in order for our clients, but also as a coach for ourselves and for individuals, for ourselves?
Oh, there's so many things for coaches. Gret and I, we have an entire 4-day program for coaches because there's just so much to unpack. The first thing is making sure that when you're working with a client, that they are in an autonomically balanced state to begin with. And that starts with some basic breathing. The basic pattern, just to do it very quickly, is if they can start to, roughly for most people, this pattern works, which is to breathe in roughly at the rate of about a 6-second inhalation and a 6-second exhalation. And if they just need to do that for just about a minute or two before they start. If they're overly sympathetic, overly stressed, or if they're overly parasympathetic and a bit lethargic or depressed, it's very difficult to work with the client in that particular state, very difficult to access resource states. And even their statement of what they want, their goals or their problem can be very skewed if they're coming from an autonomically imbalanced state. So first step is breathing. The next step is, regardless of what they say about their particular issue, is simply have them check in with all three brains. Simply just notice what their head is saying about the issue. Then check in with their heart. Have them go inside and check in with their heart intelligence and ask them what their heart really wants and feels, what's really important to them about this particular situation, what's really going on at a heart level. And then have them check in with their gut. What is their gut really saying to them about their core identity, about how safe or unsafe they're feeling, or what they should do or not do in this particular situation? And often we find with clients, the heart, the head, heart, and gut could be saying very, very different things. I know for myself, at one time I was particularly angry at a particular person. I felt it was a values violation that they were doing. I checked in with all three. My head was running amok with this wonderful story about how they've done me wrong. My heart actually felt a lot of care and compassion for them. It really still felt a lot of connection, and I really wanted to stay connected with them. And my gut was absolutely fine. My gut was saying, you talk about meta programs. My gut was saying, different strokes for different folks, no problem.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's amazing. My gut actually doesn't care. My heart wants to stay connected. It's just my head running amok with a whole bunch of internal dialogue. And until then, I thought I was mad at them. So good. And now, once they check in with all three brains, the goals can change dramatically. What they think their issue is to change dramatically, and you're at a much wiser place to begin with. There's so much more, but that's a great place to start for coaches.
That is brilliant, Marvin. Thank you ever so much for sharing that. Would you mind sharing how people can get in contact with you and your website details and where they can buy your book, Embraining?
Fantastic. Gret, over to you. You've got all the details.
Absolutely. So our website is www.embraining. That's M for mother, brain for brain, I-N-G, embraining.com. And on that website, we've got all our contact details. We also have a link to our Facebook page, and we post every day fascinating new research pieces and positive things that are about the heart, the gut, the head. Everything from ancient wisdom through to modern neuroscience is up there every day. The book is available on Amazon and on our CreateSpace e-store, and of course you can always order it through Amazon or to the e-store.
Brilliant. Thank you. And thank you to both of you for joining me today on the show. And thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in today. If you'd like to learn more about NLP, then tune in each week and also visit my website, www.donnablinston.com, where you can pick up a copy of my best-selling book, Psychobabble, a straightforward, plain English guide to the benefits of NLP. Also visit theorganicview.com and sign up for our newsletter, which will keep you updated with the upcoming shows, guests and online workshops. In the next live workshops, we'll discuss how NLP can be used to improve your relationships, both personally and professionally, learning NLP techniques that will enable you to see events and problems from multiple perspectives and to find out what is really important to you in a relationship. And once again, a huge thank you to you, Grant, and to you, Marvin. It's been an honor having you today.
Great. Thank you, Donna.
Really appreciate it.
You're more than welcome. Bye-bye.